Made possible in part by Euromart International Food Store on Springfield and Locust in Champaign, offering 200 kinds of chocolate, 40 kinds of coffee, and 200 kinds of tea. The Euromart hosts a cheese and olive tasting from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. on Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the Corkscrew Wine Emporium, presenting Urbana Uncorked, a special wine tasting event to benefit WILL AM-FM-TV on Saturday, May 15th from 1 to 4 p.m. at the Urbana Civic Center. Dozens of wines will be featured along with a silent auction and music by the Baroque Artists of Champaign-Urbana. Tickets are available at the door or in advance at the Corkscrew. For more information, call 337-7704.
Good morning and welcome back to the second hour Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Producing the program, Harriet Williamson, Travis Stansel, and Henry Frayne is at the controls this morning. Let me tell you that tomorrow in the 10 o'clock hour, Sandy Mason will be here. She is a horticulture educator with U of I Extension in Champaign County. And once a month, when things are growing, she is here. We talk about lawn and garden care. Any kind of question about things that grow in the home landscape, that's welcome. That's tomorrow. In the second part of the program, we'll be talking about British politics. And particularly, we'll be talking about Tony Blair, the British Prime Minister, and some of the challenges now that come as a result of his support of the United States and President Bush on the Iraq War. And we will have two guests with us. David Coates, he is a professor of Anglo-American Studies at Wake Forest University, and also Joel Krieger, who is professor of political science at Wellesley. And together they have authored a book titled Blair's War. So we will talk about that tomorrow morning in the 11 o'clock hour. We are here weekday mornings from 10 until noon with 10 different topics for you every week, and we always welcome your questions and comments. In this hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking with Paul Bloom. He is professor of psychology at Yale. And he says that if you really want to understand human nature, you have to start observing people before they are corrupted by language and culture. In other words, he says, you must look at babies. In his book, Descartes' Baby, How the Science of Child Development Explains What Makes Us Human, he makes the argument that all humans, even babies, see the world in two very different ways. They understand that there are physical objects in the world, but they also understand that there are immaterial ones, ones that have existence, in a sense, but there are things that we can grab onto, and that would be a thing like the mind. He looks at some recent studies showing how these two ways of knowing lead to some very uniquely human traits, things like humor and art and morality and religion, and all of that can be found in the book, which is recently published, and the publisher on the book is Basic Books. This morning, as we talk with Paul Bloom, of course, questions are welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, if you'd like to call, if you're listening here in our area, the number to call is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one's good anywhere that you can hear us. So if it would be a long-distance call, that is 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Professor Bloom, hello.
Hello, how you doing?
I'm good, thanks. And yourself?
Pretty good.
Thank you for talking with us. We appreciate
Thanks for having me here.
It's unusual for us here now. This is the second program in less than a week that we find ourselves talking about Descartes. That seems a little unusual to me, but here we are. We just last week we talked with Gerald Edelman, who is a researcher who has done a lot of thinking and writing about consciousness. And the reason that Descartes came up on that show is because essentially he was rejecting, Edelman rejects Descartesian dualism, something that you, in fact, embrace in the book and say that we're all born that way. We're born dualists. Well, first, I guess we better understand what exactly that is and talk in a kind of a basic way about Descartes. And here we're talking about the French philosopher, René Descartes, the man who uttered that phrase, is probably the most famous phrase in all of philosophy. I think, therefore, I am. So let's talk about that.
I'm actually pretty sympathetic to Edelman's theory of consciousness, where he rejects Cartesian dualism. What my book is about is how we naturally think about the world. And what I argue is that we're common sense dualists, we're intuitive dualists, in that we see the world as composed of material bodies, like tables and like our own bodies, and immaterial souls, conscious beings with emotions and desires and intentions. And our common sense conception that these two are very separate. So we see the world, as Descartes did, as composed of bodies and souls. Now, there's all sorts of interesting things that arise from this, but one disturbing thing is that, as Edelman would have pointed out, this view is roundly rejected by scientists and neuroscientists. So it's our intuitive conception. We feel it in our heart. It's very hard to shake, but it's probably mistaken.
Well, what was the argument that Descartes made about reality and how we perceive reality?
Well, Descartes made several arguments, and the one he's most famous for, the one you cited, was his method of doubt. So he pointed out correctly that you can doubt the existence of most everything, doubt the existence of God, doubt the existence of your own body, but you can't doubt the existence of yourself as a thinking being. And then he made the next step. The next step he made was that because of this, people, thinking entities, souls, are separate from their bodies.
Hmm. Well, here, and that's where we get down to this idea that says, you know, we know what the body is. We can see it, feel it, smell it, touch it, dissect it. Okay, so it's a thing that we can grab onto, and yet we also have this notion that we have, and people want to talk about different sorts of things, but we have the notion that there are these parts of us that we feel are no less real, and yet we can't grab them. That while we have a brain and we can do that same sort of thing with a body, we can look at it, we can cut it up, we can scan it, we can watch it while it works. There are some other things that we feel are equally real, but we can't do that with. What Descartes was saying was, well, yeah, there really are these two things. Yes, there is the physical body, but there's this other thing that's no less real, but it is something different.
That's right. I think in fact, our immaterial consciousness is, in a sense, more real to us than our material bodies. We could imagine, for instance, doing without our bodies. There's some very nice experiments with young children where you tell them stories about somebody who dies, and then you ask what remains. And these children know that after somebody dies, their brain doesn't work, and they won't grow any older, and they won't need food. But they do believe that the person's consciousness lives on, so they'll still love their mother, they'll still have the same likes and dislikes. So there's a common sense nature, for instance, to a belief in the afterlife. And I think one reason for this is because the notion of our conscious selves is extremely real to us, and so much so that we find it hard to imagine it ceasing to exist, while we can imagine our body ceasing to exist.
Hmm. If you quiz people about what it is that they know about the physical world and the properties of things, about physical objects, you get the idea that they understand certain things about them and about the fact that, you know, for example, if you show someone some object and then you put a box over it, they know that it hasn't gone away. They know that it's still there. It's just under the box. An adult certainly will know that. It seems that in the past we have had this idea that children actually don't get that they, at a certain point, they somehow think that the thing has disappeared, that they don't get the idea that, oh, well, it's still there, it's just underneath the box. I think it seems like what you're arguing is that now some of the more recent research that we have on issues like that, on what it is very young children know about the physical world and the properties of physical objects, that in fact that they do get that, and that these kinds of ideas, these things we have about real hard objects, the things that we can touch and feel and lift, that in fact that way of perceiving the physical world may be hardwired, that we may indeed come with that, and it's not really, maybe there's some fine tuning that goes on as we learn about the world, but that there are some things that we come with that understanding.
I think that's exactly right. For the longest time in our intellectual history, the idea was that babies started off stupid. John Locke called them blank slates. Rousseau described the baby as a perfect idiot. And the father of developmental psychology, Jean Piaget, argued that babies come in the world utterly ignorant of objects and of people. And I think one of the most significant discoveries in modern psychology over the last 20 or so years is that this view is mistaken and that babies have an extraordinarily rich understanding of both the physical world and of the social world. So if you go back to the example you gave about adults, if you take a six-month-old baby, take an object, and put the object behind the screen, so the baby sees the object and sees it going behind the screen. If you wait a minute and then remove the screen, babies expect the object to be there. If the object's missing, they look longer. They're surprised. Or take an understanding of gravity. If you pick up an object, hold it in midair, and release it, babies expect it to fall. And if it just hangs there because clever experimenters use hidden wires, again, babies are surprised. They have the same sorts of general expectations that that adults possess.
Now, here, I guess I have to ask, I'm sure some people will be asking the question, how do you know what it is babies think because you can't ask them and they can't tell you?
It's a great puzzle. I mean, how do you find out about the mental lives of creatures who can't talk? And a lot of the ways we approach babies have been developed actually from studies first intended to be used with animals, with non-human animals like chimpanzees and even rats. The main method that people use to learn about babies' mental life is they're looking. There's not a lot of things babies can do, but one thing they can do is control where they look and what they pay attention to. And so there's several very clever methods that have been devised to explore this. You could, for instance, see what surprises a baby. So you do magic tricks of the sort where you release a ball and it hangs in midair, and you see if babies look longer at events that would make adults look longer, that are surprising for adults, that would be seen as magic. If they do, it suggests that babies are surprised too. Or what you can do is use what's called habituation, which is just a fancy word for boredom. So you show babies something and over again, and sooner or later they get bored with it and they start to look away. Then you show them something new, and you see if they look longer. And if they do look longer, that shows that they do see it as something new, something different. And these methods have been used, you know, very cleverly to converge on this amazing picture of babies as knowledgeable not only about the physical world, which is what we're talking about now, but even about the social world, about how people should act and behave and respond.
Mm-hmm. And that gets at another thing that it's pretty interesting. Even from a very young age, babies do seem, that is, most of them seem, first of all, they're very attuned into other people and to their faces and to their facial expressions, but that they seem to have a pretty good ability right immediately from the start to understand what it is that's going on in the other person, to read that other person, that even though they haven't been exposed to that many other people, they're actually really pretty good at that right from the very beginning.
Yeah, some psychologists describe this ability as theory of mind, and some describe it as mind reading. And the idea is that babies are natural mind readers. Babies come in the world not only with an understanding of the physical objects and physical interactions, but also understanding social objects, people. So they're immediately drawn emotionally to people. Right, for a newborn baby, the thing a newborn baby most likes to look at is a face. What a newborn baby most likes to hear is a voice. But more than these emotional preferences, before a baby reaches his or her first birthday, they have expectations about how people should act. You could do an experiment where you show them movies with characters acting in different ways, and babies have firm expectations about how these movies should go, and they're the same sorts of expectations that adults have. I've done an experiment with Karen Wynn and Valerie Kuhlmeier, for instance, where we showed babies a character who ends up a person who is helped by one character up a hill while another character tries to push it down the hill. And then we see how babies expect that person to behave later, and we find that babies, just like you would or I would, expect a character to later approach the character that helped it, and later not to approach the character that hurt it. Hmm. And these are the sort of studies suggesting that babies have at least some rudimentary understanding of social interplay.
That is certainly, it's not surprising when you consider just how dependent babies are on their caregivers, presumably their parents and other sorts of people, because, you know, we know that for a long, long time, babies are nearly helpless. And so you would think that it would make sense that they would be so tuned in to the other individuals, particularly the adult caregivers around them, they would have to, because their very survival would depend on their ability to connect with them, to understand them, to just to kind of get what's going on around them, at least as far as their contact with other people goes.
Absolutely. And in that sense, I think babies' understanding of physical objects and babies' understanding of other people can be seen as a biological adaptation. They've evolved these capacities because a baby is a rather helpless creature, and it has great adaptive benefit to be able to cope with the world around it, both physical and social. What isn't an adaptation, though, is that when these two perspectives on the world of bodies and the world of souls, get together, there are some surprising accidents that emerge from it. And this, the main accident I'm interested in, is what I've called common sense dualism, in that because babies start off with these two ways of looking at the world, they're natural-born dualists. They see the world in terms of bodies and souls. And the sort of modern idea from neuroscience that bodies and souls are one and the same is just utterly alien to them and to us.
Hmm. Well, I'll have to ask you to talk about that a little bit more, because I'm not exactly sure what it is that you mean.
Well, when I say people are dualists, the idea is that we see people, other people, as both bodies and souls. Hmm. We see them as souls, actually, that are within bodies. And this shows up in all sorts of ways. It shows up in our language. So we talk about my body and my brain, viewing our body and our brain as things that we possess, just like we talk about my house and my child, but not what we are. We naturally make sense of stories where people's souls leave their bodies. So there's a Jennifer Gardner's movie, 13 Going on 30, the Tom Hanks movie, Big, Freaky Friday. It could list you a dozen movies and a dozen stories where the idea is that souls just leave the body. And this isn't Hollywood invention. We've had this notion as long as we've had stories. In Kafka's Metamorphosis, a guy wakes up as a cockroach. In Homer, the sailors are transformed into pigs. And people read these stories and they make sense of them. They say, I can understand that a person's body is not essential to what they are, and a body could change radically. Now, we see these things as stories, but of course most people around the world believe a far more radical sort of transformation actually does exist. Most people around the world believe that the soul survives the destruction of the body and may ascend to heaven or descend to hell, go to another world, or come to occupy another body, human or animal. And the fact that we can think that, the fact that we can make sense of the notion that someone could survive the destruction of their body is, I think, the strongest demonstration of how natural dualism is to us. It's an idea Descartes would have been perfectly comfortable with.
Hmm. And that, you think that goes back to, or that's built upon this fundamental understanding that you think that we have, that virtually that we're born with, this understanding about physical objects, maybe non-living physical objects, that they have a persistence that goes beyond our immediate ability to perceive it. I mean, I'm not putting it in a very good way.
No, I think it does come from early roots. I think that what we start off with is an understanding of objects and notion that they persist mm-hmm. over time, and an understanding of people. But these understandings are in an interesting way separate. They're disjoint. And we find it unnatural to put them together. What a neuroscientist would tell you is that what people are, all people's mental life is the functioning of a biological physical organ, the brain. Now, that might be what science tells us, but it doesn't feel right. It's intuitively unnatural. When I say these notions have their origin in the crib and in the playground, I'm not saying children start off believing in heaven and hell or reincarnation. What I am saying is children start off with minds such that the notions of heaven, the notion of hell, the notion of reincarnation is perfectly natural to us. So I think even a 3-year-old would find it totally comfortable to believe that his soul could leave his body. And in that sense, they're dualist.
Our guest is Paul Bloom. He's professor of psychology at Yale University. His book, How Children Learn the Meaning of Words, won the award for excellence from the Association of American Publishers and another award for best book in developmental psychology from the American Psychological Association. If you're interested in this subject that we're talking about here this morning, you can look at his recent book, Descartes' Baby, How the Science of Child Development Explains What Makes Us Human. It is published by Basic Books. Questions are welcome. We have a couple of people here who would like to get into the conversation, and that's certainly possible if you give us a call, 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, and toll-free 800-222-9455. We'll start off here with a caller in Champaign County, and it's line number 4. Hello.
Hi.
Hello.
I wanted to bring up some points, different perspectives on this, and then maybe hear what the response is. First one, you made a point just recently saying that mind-body unity is a modern notion. I'd like to just propose that it's really an ancient notion. Certainly, speaking from a Buddhist tradition, the unity of body-mind is taken for granted, and that the duality is considered a delusion and a misinterpretation of reality. But let me sort of extend that a little further, because when we talk about dualism, there's a further dualism of a self and other is a dualism that's superimposed, that we take for granted as natural, but is really, at least in the Buddhist psychology, proposed as a misinterpretation, and that there's a unity of reality, and that self and other is a dualism that creates all sorts of problems. And the first, which is the one you talked about, was the whole idea that there's a self that exists separate and that can transmigrate and all of that. So let me just throw all of those things out and sort of add one final point and hear what your response is that the whole idea of self, of a self that has, quote, the body or has a mind, that whole concept is another presupposition which at least needs to be questioned as a valid truth rather than taken for granted, which is what it seems natural to all of us. So I'll stop there and see what your responses are.
I think you're raising some very interesting points. I'll just make two remarks that I think are sympathetic to what you're saying. The first is that religions differ in explicit theories that they have about the relationship between body and soul. Mm-hmm. Even you know, you look at St. Augustine, you look at Aquinas, even within Christianity and related religions, you find all sorts of conceptions. My claim, though, is that the notion of a division comes naturally to us, and I think it's actually shared by most, if not all, religions to some extent. For instance, any belief framework that says that the self survives the destruction of the physical body is in some sense dualist. As for your remarks about the self-body distinction, I would make a contrast between explicit views that one holds about the nature of psychology, nature of the world, and implicit views. Explicit views, there's a whole range of them, and people can use their reason to come up with all sorts of views. They could believe that the human brain contains many consciousnesses, as some people say, maybe one for each hemisphere. Some philosophers believe that consciousness is an illusion or there's no such thing as pain. Some philosophers believe that thermostats are conscious or rocks are conscious. And what I'm interested in my research program as a psychologist isn't really to address the fundamental problems of consciousness, though I'm fascinated by them. It's to address common sense. And so my claim is, and I base this on developmental research with children and to some extent with babies, is that the common sense picture is dualistic, that there's a mind-body split, and it does endorse a strong belief in self that's continuous over time and distinct from other things. Now, it's a separate and very interesting issue what philosophers and scientists will make of this and whether these common sense notions will persist. And what I would agree with you is that in one sense, the common sense notion doesn't survive. The common sense notion that the body and the soul can be separate has not been supported by modern science.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
All right, let's go to another caller. This is someone in Urbana on line 1. Hello.
Oh, good morning.
Mm-hmm.
To have an ordinary human mind is to dream. And I think that a number of people who study cultures have observed the interplay of dreams and religion and faith and belief about an afterlife. I mean, dreams are a threshold that the living can cross to see another life, it's another state of mental being, but it's explained in various ways at different times. And
you're right.
I think that would be my point, that it's the man who, the Russian novelist you mentioned, the man who sees himself as a cockroach.
Right.
In a sense, that's the other side of the coin. He woke up to a bad dream. surrealism, is one of the many expressions of people who are... of artistic and creative people who are using that experience of dreaming in some way they give it concrete expression in the here and now.
I think your comment about dreams is actually very interesting. My claim is that people are dualists from the start, in that this is a stance they start off as babies and it just continues through their life. The alternative conception, which I have to take seriously, it's a plausible view, is that babies don't start off dualist. They don't start off with a split between body and soul. Rather, this split comes out through experience. And it could be cultural experience. It could be experience through religious training. But it could also be sort of our regular experiences as people making our way through the world. And dreams are one sort of experience that could make somebody believe that body and soul are separate. In dreams and in related experiences,
yeah,
we often have the sensation of leaving our body,
exactly,
right? And so it might be, I mean, here's an alternative developmental story, which is children start off not dualist at all, then they start to experience dreams. And then based on the dreams, they say, oh my gosh, my body and my consciousness are not one and the same because last night I left my body.
Exactly.
And I think that's an interesting possibility. I think that one way to address it would be to go younger, go into study babies, for instance, at a point where even if they are to dream, they couldn't interpret their dreams in this sort of conscious way. But I would take seriously as an alternative to my view the claim that experiences such as dreams and other related experience leading to so-called out-of-body experiences are a huge impetus to dualism and to religion more generally.
I think so. And I think infants dream. I mean, they don't wake up having to learn how to sleep.
I'm certain that infants dream. I'm not sure that they could ruminate over their dreams and take lessons from them.
Well, that comes with parental guidance. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
Well,
let's go again to another call. This is someone listening in Champaign, and it's line two. Hello.
Yes, thank you. I think you kind of alluded to this a little bit ago. You may or may not be aware that contemporary research into peptides, messenger chemicals in the body, are shown to be distributed through the entire body, and pretty much all organs in your body produce the same chemicals that the brain uses to communicate. Your intestines also produce that, your pancreas. So in that sense, what we think of as the mind would be distributed at a minimum at least throughout the entire body. These same chemicals that produce our emotional responses to things are in all our tissues. So I guess I'd like to get your take on that, and also your take on those who look at the brain as possibly an antenna/tuning receiver that just sort of tunes into a collective consciousness that's universal.
The notion which you bring up, which is that parts of the body besides the brain are involved in mental life, is, I think, an important discovery. And people like Damasio, for instance, have stressed a role of other bodily organs in the role of mental life. I think that's still a strongly anti-dualist position, because you're still rooting consciousness in the body, in the physical self, but you're just not limiting it to the brain. And I think that's an important scientific discovery, but it doesn't bring us closer to Descartes. Now, the second idea you mentioned, the brain as antenna, connecting to another world, perhaps connecting to a sort of spirit world, and in that way preserving dualism, is an idea Descartes would be extremely sympathetic to. I mean, Descartes was a smart guy, and he recognized, even though he's a dualist, even though he says body and soul link up together, body and soul are separate, he recognized they have to connect. We have to control our bodies. We have to have our experience feed into our consciousness. And so he struggled with the problem of how they connect. And for instance, he proposed that they connected via the pineal gland. That was the threshold between body and soul. And so that's a view, I think, which is very amenable to common sense. I don't think it's actually true. I think that, as a matter of fact, there's every reason to believe that our consciousness and our beliefs and desires and everything are solely the product of the physical brain. You don't need to posit any other sort of third world or alternative world to the physical and cultural worlds. One reason why I'm saying that is because of what we learn from brain damage. So if you're tempted by dualism, it's a sobering thought to realize that capacity is as central to our being as moral decision-making and our emotions and our will and our memories can be destroyed through damage to the brain.
Hmm. What about the taking that further and the notion that if we're going to make this argument that there is a consciousness, whatever kind of label you want to put on it, that is separate from the physical process that we can observe, that if individuals have that, then why not make the argument that there's some kind of unity to that, and that all individuals, something about which is particular to the individual connects with what is particular to other individuals.
And I think that those arguments have been made. I'm thinking of Carl Jung's archetypes,
sure.
Or, you know, issues of the collective unconscious. And they're very common, I think, in religious thought, in parapsychological speculations. And I think, again, they make good common sense. I'm terribly skeptical about all of this. I mean, I think if you had to pick out one idea that virtually everybody in psychology and neuroscience would say is flat wrong, it's dualism. Mm-hmm. Of any sort, either mm-hmm. at the individual level or at a collective level. The unfortunate irony is that this is the one idea that, from a common sense point of view, seems exactly right. And so I think most people, for instance, are simply maybe unaware of the scientific consensus, but if they were to be made aware, they wouldn't believe it. It's the most the Nobel Prize laureate, Francis Crick, called it the astonishing hypothesis, the idea that the brain is responsible for consciousness. And it's astonishing because it goes so much against our natural tendencies.
Let's talk with someone else in Champaign. This is line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
How do you deal with the fear of death? Isn't it denial? Isn't that where religion comes in?
It's a good question. I mean, children don't start off being afraid of death. They don't start off knowing they're going to die. But once they learn they're going to die, it's a transformational experience. Ernst Becker, in his book Denial of Death, argued that the discovery that we're going to die has this transformative psychological effect. And it's possible a lot of religious frameworks and religious viewpoints emerge from this fear of death. So, for instance, if you're afraid of death, you may well want to imagine a paradise. That would make the fear of death a lot more make it go away, because you yourself will survive the destruction of your body, and so will the people you love. But I don't think this is where the notion of an afterlife comes from. I think the notion of an afterlife is natural to us because we just don't see our souls as necessarily inextricably linked to our bodies.
Well,
and so
why are there so many different beliefs and different religions and different people that go into fanaticism?
Well, I think what religions do is they feed off a foundational belief system. The foundational belief system I'm interested in here is dualism, the idea that a soul and a body are separate. But where religions go with this is a matter of, and you're totally right, there's huge variation. They tell all sorts of different stories of what happens to the soul. And for instance, in some stories, and we're relating to fanatical beliefs, there's a paradise that awaits people who do certain things, often certain terrible things.
All right. Thank you.
All right. Other questions, comments are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. You go into some other and I think interesting areas here in the book where you talk about other aspects of human behavior, human tendencies, and how it is that they also grow out of this natural dualism that you're arguing for people. One of the areas has to do with art and how it is we respond to art, particularly art that is not representational, thing that you can't look at it and say, oh, well, that's a picture of a bowl of fruit sitting on a table. How does that grow out of this way of seeing the world that you're talking about?
Right. The most obvious way that dualism would affect how we see the world has to do with things, how we see other people, our social world, and how we make sense of things like religion and morality. But our dualism also pervades the physical world because we have the capacity to see objects as in one of two ways. We could see them simply as material objects, as in the object we talked about putting behind the screen in the experiment with a baby. But we could also see objects as intentional creations, as the product of the minds of other people. And this sort of duality of perspective has some interesting consequences. It's what makes art possible. So what makes art possible is the idea that something can be, on the one hand, a lump of clay or a splash of paint, and on the other hand, you know, a war hero and a picture of one's mother. And from a developmental point of view, what's really striking is that even very young children, say 2 and 3 year olds, have this sort of rich appreciation of art where they understand that something can be at one level a simple lump, an insignificant object, but from another perspective can represent something, can be about something. And you can see this even in 2 year olds, in some cases 1 year olds, when they make their own art, when they scribble or paint, and then they describe their art. They say, that's an airplane, that's a car. And it looks nothing like an airplane or a car. What their descriptions are is the sort of properties they want to imbue it with. Hmm. They want to sort of leave their intentional mark on these objects.
Hmm. Why also, though, another thing that you deal with, I think is interesting, has to do with the issue of forgery and why it is that we would think that a particular work would have great something that was an original creation by an artist would have great value, would mean a great deal to us. And yet, if someone made a copy and they made just the absolute most perfect copy that you could make so that you virtually couldn't tell the two things apart, that somehow the copy does not have the equivalent value to the original work, even though it looks the same.
It's a real puzzle. I mean, some philosophers have dismissed this as snobbery or, you know, worship of objects for irrelevant reasons. But I think it touches on some deep conceptions, deep aspects of our conception about how we see the world, which is if you were to only see the artwork as a splash of paint, as an object, then it wouldn't matter where it came from. But if you see it as imbued with somebody's intentional essence, as a product of a particular person's intention, then it makes all the difference in the world who made it. If I value my Chagall because of the paint, then it doesn't really matter whether or not it was a Chagall or not a Chagall. But if I value the Chagall because I see in it the product of Chagall's desires and goals and artistic intentions, then the difference between the real thing and a forgery is gigantic. And I think that the notion of an original versus a forgery is something which emerges actually even in children. I think children would be sensitive to the fact that there's a big difference between two objects, even if they look identical, so long as they're created by different people with different goals.
Our guest in this hour of Focus, Paul Bloom. He's professor of psychology at Yale. And if you're interested reading more on the subject, his book is Descartes' Baby, How the Science of Child Development Explains What Makes Us Human. It is published by Basic Books. And we have about 15 minutes left in this part of the show. If there are people who have questions, you can give us a call, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Let me ask you about something else that you deal with in the the book, and you have a chapter that has to do with disgust. And there apparently are some researchers who have particularly looked at that and done some research on that that you find very interesting. What about that you find interesting?
I'm absolutely fascinated by disgust. And one of the things I'm interested in is its moral implications, its moral connotations. The notion which I've been pursuing and I discuss in this chapter is the idea that we have two ways of looking at a person. We could see a person as a physical body, and we see a person, as a soul. And what disgust does, one of the products of this emotion, is it makes you see a person solely as a physical body, as flesh, as meat. And one kind of horrific byproduct of that is it makes the person morally insignificant. So every genocidal movement that's ever been recorded, every aspect of genocidal propaganda against Jews, against blacks, against even remarks against women or homosexuals, inevitably uses the rhetoric of disgust to say these are disgusting people. And when you see somebody as disgusting, to use a phrase by the philosopher Peter Singer, they fall outside the moral circle. They fall outside the circle of things you care about. So disgust has a dehumanizing aspect to it, and it has a dehumanizing aspect to it because it's an emotion particularly geared to one side of the human equation, to people as bodies and not as people as souls.
Hmm. Well, I think that's interesting, though, because it does make you think about, in those kinds of situations, whether we're talking about war, whether we're talking about genocide, whether we're talking about the kinds of suffering that one human being can visit on another, that if the kind of argument that you're making is so, then we have people who are going against their most natural programming. And that gets you to think about, well, what is it that you have to do to get one human being to the point where they are willing to do that to another, because it shouldn't be their natural inclination.
Well, what you're raising is a deep question of what our natural inclination is with regard to moral interactions with other people. And what's plainly natural, and we have evidence for this in babies and children, is some degree of empathy and caring and affection for those who are close to us, our kin, our family, our friends. I'm not certain it is natural in a biological sense to care about other races, to care about people in other countries. Hmm. And so I think we could be quite easily prone to stigmatize these people, to exterminate them. I think one of the great fascinating things about humanity that differentiates us from any other species is that we've used our mental powers to construct a morality that expands the moral circle to include people who it wouldn't otherwise include. So disgust is kind of the bad side of the coin. Disgust is a sinister aspect of our psyche that pushes people away from morality. But we also possess empathy and love and other like emotions that could pull people into the moral circle and make us care about them.
Do you think that I'm not sure quite how to formulate this question. I'll just do it this way. That a belief in God is a natural quality that human beings have?
I don't think a belief in God is innate. Mm-hmm. I don't think we're born believing in God. I think a belief in God is something people come to and is influenced by culture. And so there's nothing particularly inherently psychologically unnatural about atheism, about a lack of belief in God. On the other hand, I think a belief in God, as it comes extremely naturally to us. So we're not born with it. But once we're exposed to it, we seize upon it and we find it extremely natural. And we do so for at least two reasons. One reason is that we are, again, common sense dualists. And so the notion of an omnipotent, omniscient creature that's a soul without a material body is actually quite conceivable to us. It doesn't seem freakish or unnatural. So we could accept that. The second reason is because when we look at the material world and we see structure in the material world, we see complexity in design, we see this as the product of a divine designer. Now, Darwin's accomplishment in the theory of natural selection was explaining how structure and design in a natural world could come about even if nobody is there designing things. It could come about through a process of driven by mutation, by accident. But we don't see things that way. Naturally, when you see things in the world, you see animals and trees and even clouds and mountains, the natural tendency is to take these things as designed, as created. And there again, God is a natural solution to the problem that's raised.
Hmm. So it's not necessarily that any particular religion or even religion is something that we come with, but it's the fact that we can accept that it's not a particular stretch. That's
exactly
the thing that we sort of come with.
That's exactly right. I don't think anybody's going to find, you know, genes for belief in God or genes for belief in religion. I don't think it's as simple as that. What I do think is humans have a range of propensities and habits, common sense dualism being one of them, a desire to explain things in certain ways being another, certain things like fear of death, as one of the callers mentioned, being a third. And all of these go together to make religion and religious belief extremely extremely natural for us, so that when children are exposed to it, they'll seize on it. And in some cases, they'll manufacture it even if they aren't exposed to it. There's some really nice studies on children's beliefs about where things come from, where animals come from and mountains come from and clouds come from, which find that in a sense they're more creationist than adults. Children tend to be in some way more religious in all sorts of ways regarding life after death and regarding the creation of the natural world, more so than adults because of these natural tendencies.
Hmm. We have, just want to tell people listening, we have about 5 minutes maybe on the program. Someone wants to get in real quick here with a question. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. We talked earlier in the program, about the fact that so much of science wants to reject dualism.
That's right.
Exactly. I talked about the fact that I had this conversation with Gerald Edelman, and he was talking about consciousness, who had this idea that there dualism, there is no such thing, that what the mind is, it's the result of physical processes that we can see, measure, and understand. And that so much of this, it seems that science has come along and has challenged so many of these notion. So what do we do with that? I mean, how do we think about the fact that we also have created science as a way of looking at the world, and it's a very different way of looking at the world?
It's a terrible problem. I mean, there's a great clash between common sense, what we know from common sense, and what science, which we ourselves created, tells us about the world. We've had this clash before. Common sense tells me that physical objects are solid through and through, but science tells me they're made out of tiny particles and fields of energy, and they're mostly empty space. Mm-hmm. And the way we cope with that clash is we say, well, common sense is wrong. There really are such things as atoms and protons and electrons, even though that doesn't make much intuitive sense to me. And you might think the same thing will happen with regard to soul. So we might say common sense is dualistic, but science tells me the mind is a product of the brain, so I'll just go with science. And some people think this is the way it's going to go. I think that's way too optimistic. I think that underestimates the force of the clash here. Because if you give up on common sense dualism, you give up a lot. You give up on the conception, for instance, that the soul will rise up to heaven when you die. And that's more than a lot of people would want to lose. The Pope was recently explicit on this a couple of years ago. A couple of years ago, in a very famous statement, he said, evolutionary theory might be right. There's good evidence to believe that Darwin's theory of evolution is right, and we can accept that. But then he added, but the idea that the spiritual soul emerges from matter and is not the product of a divine force, that we can't accept. That would violate the truth according to our religion. And I think he has it exactly right. I think there's a lot of things we can give up, but the tension between common sense, dualism, and science is a serious tension indeed.
A couple of other callers here. We'll try to get them in. Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Hello. Hi.
Yes.
Hello.
Hi. I was just curious, that idea that you have about common sense dualism, is that something that you think that just people maybe in the United States are common sense dualists? Or, I mean, do you see that as something that goes across cultures? Or?
It's a good question. I think it's totally universal. And I think that for a couple of reasons. One reason being that beliefs that rest on common sense dualism, such as the survival of the soul after the death of the body, are, I think, universal across time and place. So that's one reason to believe it's not limited to the United States. The second reason is studies with babies and young children. to the extent these studies pan out and we find that people are dualistic before they're tainted by culture and language and religious training, that would suggest it's part of our human nature, not part of our culture.
Okay, because I know that there are a lot of religions where people consider, you know, God to be embodied, and there's also a lot of religions where, I mean, there's a lot of cultures where people, you know, really believe that in a unified world. So it's kind of weird to think that that's a universal, that common sense dualism is a universal when people state that they, you know, that they don't think that. Do you know what I'm talking about?
I do. And there's all sorts of ways religions could play out in very different ways. But the property I think that they share, I think that this is either universal or very near universal, is a belief in the survival of the self after death of the body. They may describe it in very different ways. They may talk about reincarnation or a world of ancestors or going to some sort of cosmic center. Mm-hmm. But I think very few cultures believe that when you're dead, that's it, period. Your brain's gone, you're gone, no more. I think that view is psychologically unnatural and actually held largely by some people who are neuroscientists and psychologists, but not many others.
Yeah, that's really interesting contradictions in thinking, I think. Thank you very much.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you. We'll try real quick here for line number two in Urbana. Hello.
Yeah, I have a recent the first granddaughter and my daughter taught her sign language. And I spent some time with her recently. She's not quite a year and a half yet. But, they taught her when she heard she knows about planes and the jet sound. But, you know, she'd point, and then all of a sudden she'd do the sign for more. Like, you know, for example, like I was as an adult I was in control, I could give her more.
Uh-huh.
But what about any of these studies that have used, in terms of, the other one is brought out in terms of frustration, maybe this is where they go through this, this aggravation of not getting what they want, but it's part of that they can't communicate. And that where sign language does help in that regard. So there have been any studies in this area?
This is a bit far afield from common sense dualism, but it's a great issue, and I've studied it. I study word learning in another aspect of my work, and there's a lot of work suggesting that before children learn to speak, they have, you know, desires and intentions and goals, and often they struggle to get it out. And this might pre-exist language. The other thing I wanted to say is one of the more interesting findings from study of language development is the development of a sign language like American Sign Language seems to be exactly parallel to the development of a language like English. People look for all sorts of differences, but the differences don't seem to appear. And so they seem to sort of capture the very same systems both of language, syntax and grammar and morphology, as well as the same systems of communication and emotional expression.
We're going to have to stop because we've used our time. If you'd like to read more on the subject, look for the book that we have talked about. It's titled Descartes' Baby, How the Science of Child Development Explains What Makes Us Human. It's published by Basic Books by our guest Paul Bloom. He's professor of psychology at Yale. Professor Bloom, thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
The broadcast today made possible with support from Lincoln Square Mall in Urbana, with more than a dozen shops, businesses, and restaurants, including unique baby gifts with custom baby bedding and accessories, Enzo's Pizza, Brownfield Sports, Sticklin Insurance, and Field of Greens. The program also made possible by grants from 10,000 Villages in downtown Champaign and Crossroads Global Handcrafts, 428 North Main in Bloomington, offering ground and whole bean coffee purchased from farmers using internationally recognized fair trade standards. That's it for us here on Focus, but we